mommy, no more daddy. Ain't we lucky? Ain't we happy?
Everybody's all so happy.
That was Victor McRae's version of Everybody's Happy Now by Aldous Huxley, and this is Gnostic Media's podcast, episode number 250. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. Episode 250, Dr. Hans Utter returns to complete our investigational series into the history of FM radio, titled The Secret History of FM Radio, Part 4. I Am the Network, No Translation Without Transformation. This episode was recorded on June 4 and is being released on Saturday, June 11, 2016. Dr. Utter returns for his 13th time, and he's also got a new blog up at mindcontrolmusic.wordpress.com, I think is the correct address for that, aside from his HansUtter.com, and also there are the links to all of the previous episodes with him, as well as a brand new episode from this week on Unspun, and I think he will be on next week for Unspun as well. So that'll make it like 25 shows total for the entire expose that we've done through all of this, and I do recommend that everybody watch all of it. So anyway, check out the other episodes to this if you haven't already, and you'll really need that for a prerequisite for all of this anyway. And contributions, let's see, this episode is brought to you by Alexandra, Steve, Matthew, Jan, Adam, Oscar, Casey, Gregory, times two, Neil, Jerica, Scott, Hannon, Jonathan, Carlos, Barry, Paul, William, Heath, Michael, John, Tresser, Joseph, Lewis, Kathy, who made two donations, Barry, Roger, Robert, Susan, Willem, Alan, Paul, and that was Paul number two, Kieran, Derek, Randy, and another Paul, Paul number three. And we also had a couple of unknown Bitcoin donations and one Bitcoin donation from Anthony, and thanks to all of you for making this episode possible. And Of course, we do our best to provide just about everything here for free, so please check out the website, the store page, get some of the archives, get a membership, make a donation, support the show. We can't do it without you. And the views expressed by the authors and guests are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself, the host, or Gnostic Media. And the website is GnosticMedia.com, GnosticMedia.com. Reach me through the contact form or at contact@GnosticMedia.com. Thanks for listening and thank you for your support. And here's part four with Dr. Utter. I am the network, no translation without transformation. Enjoy. Dr. Hans Utter, welcome back to the Gnostic Media Podcast. It's good to have you here.
Thanks, John. It's great to be here.
And you're back today for your final, for the final installment of The Secret History of FM Radio. And it's I Am the Network, no translation without transformation. And what can the audience expect for this final installment of The Secret History of FM Radio?
Well, what I thought I'd focus on today was bringing out a little bit more of the details of stuff that I've been talking about and just see how this stuff was deployed and look a little bit more in some of the network stuff I started talking about, but primarily just to kind of give a real concrete background for how this worked and hopefully to show the extent to which the entire public can be influenced and transformed. And I really think that this 1960s were such a pivotal decade in that you had these series of shocks that were administered to the culture. And then you had these reactions which came in a periodic way. And so I think that the radio, at least in the nascent stages of the FM radio, really served as not only the primary organizing vector for the counterculture, but I think it also really served to attract many, many people into the use of drugs, into participation in the movement. And as we've talked about before, the shutdown of the movement, the changing of the drugs from, you know, LSD becoming very contaminated, people, and then going into heroin, hard drugs, and just really having the human wreckage, the wreckage of the sexual revolution, etc. You know, so by the early 80s, people were ready for disco and cocaine and whatever. And
so we're on the verge of another cocaine and heroin comeback, apparently, in the next 4 or 5 years, I suppose.
I think it's already back. I mean, there's a lot of people now that even college grads, people that are, you know, out of college a few years that are really getting into heroin, and it's kind of regaining its underground chic status. So I think heroin is really becoming a major thing right now, for sure.
Now, I smoked opium a couple times back in my college days, but I've never even done heroin. I've never wanted to. So all you folks that think that's cool, all the power to you. Whatever. Anyway, so where are we going next here? Now, I came across that. I was just reading about that spins thing. I mean, isn't that fascinating how they call it spin?
Yeah. Well, I wanted just to it started out with that, just from the Aquarian conspiracy, and then a little bit look at the changing faces of man again, and then
changing images of man. Correct.
Sorry, changing images of man, changing faces. You know, whatever. It's the same. Just kidding. But and yeah, so I wanted, you know, just kind of, we'll just check this out. Let me just go ahead and start out. I'm just gonna read a little selection from that because I love reading. So. This is from page 216. So networks, quote, have a powerful and refreshing impact on social policy. They represent a spontaneous social resistance to massive bureaucratic trends. Okay. Luther Gerlach and Virginia Hine, anthropologists who have studied social protest networks since the 1960s have christened the contemporary networks SPINs, segmented polycentric integrated networks. A spin gains its energy from coalitions, from the combining and recombining of talents, tools, strategies, numbers, contacts. It is like Gandhi's grouping of unities. Like a brain, the spin is capable of simultaneous connections at many points. Its segments are the small groups, which hang together loosely on the basis of shared values. Occasionally, by a kind of friendly fission, the spin has a spin-off. The multiplicity of groups strengthens the movement. Whereas the conventional organizational chart would show neatly linked boxes, the organizational chart of a spin would look like a badly knotted fishnet with a multitude of nodes of varying sizes, each linked to all others directly or indirectly. These cells or nodes in the social protest movement are local groups ranging from a handful of members to hundreds. Many form for a single task and are here today, gone tomorrow. Each segment of a spin is self-sufficient. You can't destroy the network by destroying a single leader or some vital organ. The center, the heart of the network, is everywhere. A bureaucracy is as weak as its weakest link. In a network, many persons can take over the functions of others. This characteristic is also like the brain's plasticity, with an overlap of functions so that new regions can take over for damaged cells. Bureaucracy is less than the sum of its parts. A network is many times greater than the sum of its parts. And I'll just skip over here a little more. These networks produce valuable local mutations. News of successful experiments travel swiftly across the movement linkages, and they are widely adopted. Most people don't see them or think they are conspiracies. Often networks take similar action without conferring with each other simply because they share so many assumptions. It might also be said that the shared assumptions are the collusion. The Aquarian conspiracy is, in effect, a spin of spins, a network of many networks aimed at social transformation. The Aquarian conspiracy is indeed loose, segmented, evolutionary, redundant. Its center is everywhere. It goes on and on, but basically...
I'm glad that you started this with that section there, because... Two nights ago, I was sitting there reading that exact part, and just totally amused at the spin of spins and this whole system of networks that they call even spins, you know. and it's not a conspiracy, it's just a bunch of networks.
Well, you know, of course, this is based on H.G. Wells' book, right? But the Open Conspiracy or whatever, so... And this connects definitely with H.G. Wells' idea and ideas, you know, for this sort of rebirth of society. And, you know, I do want to stress that I'm sure the majority of people involved in these networks or spins have very good intentions. Or
sure.
Are there for the babes, for the beer, for the LSD.
Willful idiots, willful dupes, etc.
Yeah,
we've all been one at one time or another for this or that.
Yeah, but with the spin, this idea is how it's possible to bring in these agents of influence, right? So how you can have, you know, certain people, you know,
you're cutting out there. Repeat what you just said.
Well, the spins show how it's possible for specific agents of influence to have kind of a vast effect, right? So this is how
kind of have a what effect, dude. I've been telling you for a year to call your internet company. What did you say again? You're gonna have to repeat that whole thing.
The spins have the potential for being influenced by single or multiple agents of influence, basically people that can go in and change particular nodes in these networks, and this can have a ripple effect throughout, you know, the whole series of networks. And that this kind of explains or starts to explain how, you know, you have not only the spread of the sort of the radio and the music, but then also you have the spread of this hippie counterculture, really kind of out of the blue, right? It was certainly there in inceptional form with the Beatniks, but the Beatniks were never really that prominent, right? They're more of a literary movement. They were pretty much centered in either, you know, East Coast intellectual circles or West Coast type of things.
When you get in between with the Bohemians and the all of these Bohemian movements, that actually kind of appears to be a core thread that goes throughout all of this. The older Bohemians back in the 1800s in Europe, and then the new Bohemians, and they kind of become the Beatniks, etc., that come out of that. Because out of Bohemia, we get the Bohemians first generation, then second generation. We also get the Bohemian Club, where all of these governmental agents, etc., are running from. But the Bohemians appear to be, you know, I have it mapped in the brain databases. We have different levels: the Lost Generation, the hippie Lost Generation, the Bohemians, the hippie movement, rock movement, and then transhumanism, as all based around this Bohemian theme.
Well, you know, one of the primary tenets in any kind of Bohemian arts movement, I mean, we have many, many different, you know, communes springing up in America in the 19th century. Even things like the Mormons kind of started out of something like that, like Joseph Smith, who was taking peyote with the Indians or whatever. But there was a bunch of these different types of communes and movements, and these have kind of been there throughout our history. But these mass movements are a little bit distinct because, you know, before you did have much more of these localized movements, but suddenly you see these things just sweeping through the entire fabric of the country, right? I mean, you know, it's one thing to have a religion like Mormonism, but if you look at some of these communes, you know, you don't have that many people. You may have a couple offshoots, but you don't have millions of people around the world suddenly getting involved in them. So I think that's a distinction, but there's certainly a definite connection with that. And this idea that, you know, to remove yourself from society is also part of that. And also, it was interesting, I was at this conference this week talking about with you earlier, hanging out with Zizek, Slavoj Zizek, who's like number one most popular philosopher. But he draws a lot on Lacanian theory, and this is the idea that the symbolic order, right? The symbolic order, which means our system of signs and symbols and rules and all that, needs to be shattered. Does it? I mean, this idea of shattering the symbolic order.
Well, that's how do you identify anything? So then essentially you come to a state of non-thinking. That's what they want us in, because that's the most easily controlled state. Mysticism is the tool of tyrants. So if you're not, you know, language, the alphabet, all of that is symbols, right? And everything that we deal with, I mean, we're looking at symbols all the time of things. So if we don't have any recognition of that and stop any of that, we're shutting off the minds, which then we come into a state like Jiddu Krishnamurti and Aldous Huxley were selling, where you have the ultimate slave, essentially.
Yeah, and in fact, Aldous Huxley, what's interesting about him is he was following Vedanta, which is, based off kind of ancient Hindu philosophy. And then suddenly, when he took LSD, which I think was in 1953, he wrote The Doors of Perception. He's like, hey, we don't need to do yoga. We don't need to do any gradual transformation work. We just need to take this drug, and we can have direct mystical experience. And then he started saying that it's actually harmful to engage in any type of sustained or disciplined practice, because you may never reach a spiritual state. You may never get this cosmic realization you can have instantly just from taking a dose of mescaline or LSD. And linked with that is Jiddu Krishnamurti's idea. And I've had a number of people communicate with me saying, oh, I really like Krishnamurti, but I'll say straight up that there's also Yuji Krishnamurti, which is pretty weird. There's two Krishnamurtis, and they both are philosophers, and they both were connected with the Theosophical Society. But in a sense, they lead to the same path. So what Jiddu Krishnamurti talks about is this choiceless awareness, right? Choiceless awareness. Okay, have a pure awareness without, you know, direct apprehension of the world around you. No religion, literature is a drug, music is a drug, any spiritual practice is a waste of time, you know, this and this and that. And in his earlier books, he's writing this kind of very beautiful prose, you know, describing the clouds rising over the ocean. And he's like, and my mind was clear, and I was, you know, I became one with everything, whatever. But basically, in a kind of a microcosm of what Krishnamurti did to his followers, when he was brought out as the basically new Messiah, right? He was vetted from a very young age. And he had all these people had left everything and were following him. And they were, you know, moved into these communes. They gave all their money to the you know, Theosophical Society. And he came out one day and gave a speech. He's like, I'm dissolving the order. There's nothing to believe in. There's basically no truth. You know, your family structures are just binding you. You can't, there's no path. The path is whatever. And just dissolved the order and completely shattered everybody who had believed. Sure. For, you know, so, and that's kind of, you know, in a microcosm what happened in the 60s.
I have a really good quote here from Jiddu Krishnamurti where he says, knowledge seems so utterly nonsense to me. So having any knowledge of anything, of course, now people need to understand, now he wasn't just selling some Hindu philosophy. He was of the Hindu Brahma caste, the highest caste in India, selling a philosophy for the lower caste, which is what the Brahmins have done for thousands and thousands of years to keep the lower caste system under control. So if you're not asking questions, knowledge is who, what, where, and when. So that's your foundation of everything you know in the universe. And he says, knowledge seems so utterly nonsense to me. Well, how do you know that? How would you even know that knowledge is nonsense without knowledge?
Well,
you know,
yeah,
it creates a paradoxical situation, but, you know, Krishnamurti was hanging out with Joseph Campbell and Aldous Huxley and David Bohm, and he heavily influenced Brian Geisen. You know, he's influenced by Annie Besant and all of your, you know, the perennial tradition, which was also created by Aldous Huxley, etc. So this is one big circle jerk of these social engineers working with the CIA and MKUltra.
Yeah, well, I just correct you a little bit that Jiddu Krishnamurti, his philosophy actually was not Hindu at all. He, when he dissolved the order, right? He gave up his mantle as the, you know, the world savior. He didn't even talk. He criticized all religions, so it really wasn't Hindu at all. It was just this system of sort of leading you into this sick. What it leads you into is just a cyclical type of thinking, choiceless awareness. Any knowledge is bad. Any belief is bad. Anything I do, music is bad. I mean, I'll be honest. Like
state of do nothingness, essentially. And no action, no thinking, just a blob, which is what MKUltra was creating.
Well, yeah, but at the same time, you have this effort to get this choiceless awareness, direct awareness, and you create this. You basically separate yourself and create this sort of mental split right within the mind. And his evil twin, who's very interesting, is this guy named Yuji Krishnamurti. And Yuji Krishnamurti was a lecturer for the Theosophical Society. Then he had this Kundalini awakening, and I guess he was like a homeless guy for a while, and then he became enlightened. But what he says, his books are like, thought is your enemy, mind is a myth. You have to destroy every thought, every belief. You know, your mind is your worst enemy. Any thought is like a poison. It is just the body itself.
But why didn't he destroy that belief that thoughts were bad?
Well, you know, he's using thought to convey that. That's the thing.
It's, right. So, but why didn't he kill that? I mean, these people don't even understand the paradox in their own statements and their beliefs, because to have that belief, shouldn't you go in then by your own belief and then destroy that belief?
Yeah, well,
this might have just gone over some people's heads, but I mean, it's like if it's your belief that all thought and thinking is bad and you have to destroy all thought and belief and all that, shouldn't you destroy all that thought and belief as well?
Yeah, well, supposedly after you destroy all that, then your body itself awakens,
and then you float into space and you become Jesus or
No,
or Krishnamurti.
No, he said enlightenment is boring. You don't want what I have. You don't want it. You don't need it. You're too.
You don't want what I have. So then he's like a taking authority that he's so much grander than everybody else. So then they, it's reverse psychology to get them to want to come and do what he was doing apparently by doing nothing and destroying all thought.
Yeah, well, then there's this other thing they talk about, you know, how he had all these different marks on his body and had these, you know, kundalini, which is awakening of the, you know, the chakras and all this stuff. So there's, yeah, in fact,
so he had some serpents in his body.
There was supposedly, like, yeah, some kind of like serpent looking things coming out different, you know, when he had. But the whole thing is that, you know, I know people who got into, because you go through this stuff and you start. And this is also an example of people go through the whole guru thing, right? A lot of his followers were coming from like Rajneesh or these other gurus. And just so people know, this is all very much connected with what we're going to hit later. But basically, so all these people had been sort of traumatized, right, by believing in some guru. And then, you know, either guru slept with their wife or whatever, you know, or something like that. You know, there's all kinds of scandals with a lot of these gurus. And then they found this guy, the anti-guru, the non-guru, who's telling you the gurus are all false. You know, I'm not a guru. Don't follow me. Don't listen to me. But thought is your enemy. Mind is a myth. You know, da-da-da. And but he does have a few interesting things to say. He talks about thought being external. He said thought is not actually in your mind, but thought is like this external field of almost being broadcast into your head, which is a little, maybe a little scary if you think about it. But anyways, so these figures, right? And even, you know, well, if this guy at the conference listens to this, hey, no, nothing personal, but this guy is walking around with a copy of Aldous Huxley's books. And I love Aldous Huxley. He's the greatest. He changed my life. And just, he said, I carry these books everywhere I go. And he loved Aldous Huxley so much. And I was kind of like, dude, you know, I mean, the idea, like in Huxley's last book, Island, he goes from, you know, sort of a more spiritual approach and then sort of the dystopian Brave New World to this island where everyone takes these drugs and is happy and they have the spiritual states by taking the drugs and everyone lives in harmony by, you know, having these periodic being dosed all the time on psychedelics. So it's actually a utopia, not a dystopia. And so that's what he evolved to in his last book. And of course he died, you know, with he was injected with a large dose of LSD. So he died tripping. I mean,
well, that's the official story that Sidney Cohen had told Laura Huxley to inject him with LSD. But apparently there was a whole bunch of other drugs there, too. And, you know, Laura Huxley probably should have been arrested for murder. But when you get in and you look at the facts of that story and the letter that comes in from Julian Huxley and all right at that time, it's a pretty scandalous affair. And it's timed right with JFK's assassination. Of course, JFK was Huxley's nemesis and all of this stuff. So, you know, you got to take that whole story with a grain of salt. I mean, if it's true, Laura Huxley should have been arrested, you know, for murder.
Yeah, but the thing is, some of these myths, they're valuable in that why is that even being propagated? You can kind of analyze
right
as the thing. But you, speaking of Huxley, of course, in his connection with Gerald Hurd and Osman, you know, the guy changed the name to psychedelics. Originally, his study, he was talking about how they produce schizophrenia-like symptoms, and then he changed the name.
Humphrey Osmond, right?
Yeah, yeah. And then he said, oh, even though originally they do mimic schizophrenia, they actually produce enlightenment, or they produce these wonderful states. Right. So he changed the name, even though. But
and then 10 years later, I did a whole article on this, and then 10 years later, we see the guys who created the new word still using the old words that they, you know.
Yeah, old habits die hard. But, you know, Gerald Hurd was friends with Claire Booth Luce, Henry Luce, right? So we see the main, one of the main players in the vast social engineering project, who I'm going to bring up here just a bit later, just to show how this stuff works. In a situation that's not quite as complex as a whole FM radio. But let me just...
You know what? Before you move on, you know, before we go any further, Hans, just hold that thought. But I wanted to read a paragraph or two here from my article, Spies in Academic Clothing, because it covers what we were just discussing, Laura Huxley. And it says, Cohen, regarding Sidney Cohen, was also consulted when Laura Huxley injected Aldous with a lethal dose of LSD and other drugs. The same day of John F. Kennedy's assassination, a topic that deserves a full investigation on its own. However, I'll say briefly that a careful analysis of Laura's specious claims regarding the matter and her letter to Julian and Juliet Huxley of December 8, 1963, which everyone should read here, suggests that Aldous was actually murdered by her and or the entire story is a fabrication to further market LSD for MKUltra. Right up to the end. As Laura states at the end of her 8-page letter, quote, "If the way Aldous died were known, it might awaken people to the awareness that not only this, but many other facts described in Island are possible here and now. Aldous asking for moksha medicine while dying is a confirmation of his work, and as such is of importance not only to us, But to the world, it is true we will have some people saying that he was a drug addict all his life and that he ended as one. But it is history that Huxley's stop ignorance before ignorance can stop Huxley's, Laura Huxley." And then I go on, however, if you read the letter, it's clear that Aldous never asked for moksha medicine, and it's all based on Laura's interpretation of events and body language. This entire charade became the foundation for using psychedelics to aid in death.
Yeah. No, that's very wild. And I'm just going to hit a couple points here, man, that's going to completely dial into that. Because you know, well, we talked a little bit about, again, these spins, but we have this theory of social turbulence, right? Based on
Kurt Lewin.
I got it, man. Kurt Lewin, William Sargent. His ghost is hanging over me.
Well, just we made a joke about electroshock last time, so I was just giving you something.
Yeah. You know, speaking of electroshock, one of my friends, they've been giving him electroshock. I said, you know, he's like, he's getting ECG now. I'm like, excuse me for swearing on the show, but like, what the fuck, dude? You're getting ECG? He's like, yeah, I can't play guitar anymore now, but I'm much more calm. I'm like, this is in 2016. You know, ECT is having a comeback, electroconvulsive therapy. It's like, you know, that's another one of those, you know, therapies where the cure is worse than the disease.
Right.
But anyways, so social turbulence theory, you know, developed at Tavistock. We got Fred Emery and Trist, and they basically, they had a book called A Choice of Futures, which really looks at how these spins, and this is certainly embedded to a certain extent in the Aquarian conspiracy and to much greater in the changing images. But basically there's basically a way of, just as you give someone ECD, you give the whole society a series of universal cathartic shocks. So you have certain events that ripple to the entire society. JFK, 9/11, Michael Jackson dying, maybe not Michael Jackson, but you know, these are cathartic shocks. And it is what creates what he described as a form of managed psychosis. Okay. And around this time too, I'm going to play a little bit of a lecture on the Poetry of Madness, which where they're talking about insanity. Schizophrenia is actually healthy, right? This insanity is actually...
Especially for the controllers, because if you're in a state of insanity, you can be manipulated in the direction that they want.
Exactly. And so what happens is, during the position of shock, the adoption of psychotic values, or values that would have seemed psychotic or completely outside the realm of society, becomes normal. This shock induces a transformation, and these other values can be induced or introduced to the society. And I think an example, again, you look at the hippies. I mean, not only did that create a massive split, right, between the youth, between the idea of the parental authority, between the idea of any kind of American culture, but it also created a split between those that were hippies, those that were not. But it really was incredibly disturbing to the people that were involved in it, it was like they were in a different world, and that was their normative state, right? But for the rest of society, it also created shockwaves, you know, reverberating. So you get kind of a dual-tiered type of shock they're employed. And so Trist predicted in 1963 that society would soon enter a period of permanent social turbulence. This is what Trist was predicting in 1963. And so in later 1975, a later book, he lays out the three stages of this transformation. And so it's basically societal disintegration and then a rebuilding of new paradigms. So the first stage is called superficiality. And this is basically when people start to break away from the values of the past. He called the sacred societal values, Judeo-Christian civilization or Christian civilization, superficiality, collapse of moral judgment. Okay. And it's also a total rejection of the past, a total rejection of the foundation of society. The next stage is called segmentation. And this is when the larger institutions of society start to experience the reverberations of these changes that are happening on the lower levels. So the institutions themselves begin to show these signs of sort of disintegration or rejection of these values. But then it continues on, and then people become increasingly related in more and more smaller, paranoid, isolated groups, right? More and more paranoid, more and more socially isolated. And then even this trickles down to the family, shattering the family itself, shattering the family union.
Just like we discussed in the secret history or music, mind control, and psychobiology, with the subdivisions within music between teenagers and even within the family itself.
Yeah, yeah, and in this case, you know, we're kind of looking at the strategy, and then a little bit later we're gonna see actually the actual implementation of that. And then the third layer is to plunge society into a deeper level of instability called dissociation. So it's a state of dissociation in which the individual becomes the entire societal unit. The individual withdraws from society into a world where reality and fantasy are indistinguishable. Man trusts no one. Decision-making is given way to feeling states, right? And he also talks about a wired society. And this is in the early 70s, where everyone's wired in by computers, personal gadgets, and they're reduced to these individual isolated units through the dissociation stage. And this is a new order he calls the new order of the information age. Again, this is this is when they had the giant, you know, computers filling up entire office buildings to print out one little punch card to answer 10 plus 10 or something. I mean, not that bad. But so that's basically the framework, at least one version of the framework. And you're welcome to chime in there. I just wanted to turn quickly to the changing images of man and how they describe this too. They describe it in a lot more compelling or friendly way. They kind of, you see a lot of the Joseph Campbell hero's journey stuff in there, right? But so the premises, there's five, this is one, page 183. Okay, five premises grow out of the preceding discussions. This is about the rebirth of society, the new world or whatever. Okay, one, an interrelating set of fundamental dilemmas growing ever apparently more pressing, seeming to demand for their ultimate resolution a drastically changed image of man on Earth. We seem able to tolerate neither the ecological consequences of continued material growth nor the economic effects of sudden stoppage. We fear the implication of greatly increased control of technological development, yet sense that such control is imperative. We recognize the fatal instability of economic nationalism and a growing gap between rich and poor nations, yet seem unable to turn the trend around. And it just keeps going on. His need for creative work and, you know, discrepancy, legitimacy of business government, which must be dismantled. So we face a cultural crisis of meaning. It is not clear who is at the helm, how the ship is steered, nor what distant shores we should be aiming for. I love that little poetic metaphor. So not quite as blunt as Trist, but basically saying the same thing. Okay. So basically what we have to do is find a new way out of this. We are trapped every side. We can't go here. We can't go there. We can't think. We can't not think. We can't love. We can't not love. We're just caught in these double binds everywhere, proliferating with no way out. And the solution is, okay, number two, there are increasingly evident signs of the imminent emergence of a new image of man. It is a new image in the sense of being very much a challenger to the dominant scientific worldview, materialized economic man, but is not new, going back to the power of myth, magic, and ritual found in the past.
Which is funny because this is all out of SRI and all of their scientific research. So then they're using science to undo science and technology, apparently. I mean, again, these contradictions and double binds and everything and all that they do.
Well, check this out. It goes on. Okay, chapter 6 describes some characteristic images of man, which is at once compatible with the reemergent perennial philosophy and is well adapted for dealing with humankind's contemporary dilemmas. Of special interest to the Western world is that Freemasonry traditions played a significant role in the birth of the United States, as attested to by the Great Seal, right? So talking about perennial philosophy, Freemasonry, transcendental image, everyone on the lodge, so going, alluding to Freemasonry. Number three, there's a serious mismatch between modern industrial state cultures and institutions and the emerging new images of man. Okay, this mismatch, you know, produces, et cetera, all the problems. Four, there is and will continue to be deep psychological resistance to both the new image and its implications. No aspect of a person's total belief and value system is so unyielding to change as his basic sense of identity, his self-image. It is a well-known phenomenon in psychotherapy that the client will resist and evade the very knowledge he needs most to resolve his problems. Similar problem probably exists in society, and there's suggestive evidence, both in anthropology and in history, that a society tends to hide from itself knowledge, which is deeply threatening to the status quo, etc. Okay, so we have resistance and structures, and then finally, number five, degree to which the needed characteristics described in chapter five are realized may well determine the degree to which the highly undesirable future outcomes, economic collapse, a garrison police state, can be avoided. Okay, so these premises are based on, again, you know, some of it sounds pretty cool. Hey, you know, let's connect mythological self. Let's get rid of the technology. Let's go back. You know, let's go back and make our plowshares out of hammer iron, you know, and just live like this society for creative.
Live like serfs and, you know, on a field for the Lord, for whomever we produce for, you know. And regarding his thing about, you know, all of these different movements and whatnot, and to break away from that control. This is from Stephen Hager, the former chief editor of High Times magazine. He says, "But that's the way spooks play their games. If it's going to be a social movement against whatever you're doing, it's best if you secretly create and orchestrate that movement against yourself right away, so that never does any unintended damage to your personal fortunes."
Yep, exactly. And so, and what I thought I'd do, I wanted to play this audio clip here, and we can let it run maybe just for a couple minutes. And this is, I found this to be pretty interesting because I think this basically typifies what we're talking about, but then you can kind of hear it in their own words, so to speak. And so just give me a second here, but this is just a number of scientists, doctors, and talking about this idea of madness, right? The idea that we can find poetry and transcendence through madness. And it's pretty interesting lecture because you can hear like some kind of weird little beads being played and all kinds of stuff. And so it's kind of neat. And you get to hear Allen Ginsberg, who, by the way, first read Howl 1957 on KPFA. And so this stuff, you know, even that FM radio show is acting like it started in 67, 68. No, this stuff was going back to 63. It's pretty much when it started. So I'm going to go ahead and run this clip for a second. And so check this out. Actually, just give me a moment. I brought up part two. I'm going to bring up part one. And this is at the Esalon Institute. Okay. So this is, and it's, you know, and, you know, I mean, I used to be a big fan of Joseph Campbell, but, you know,
I did too. You know, we were young and wrong. It's okay.
He was good friends with Jerry Garcia. I'm sure you know that.
He was also good friends with Aleister Crowley. And you know that you saw that stuff. I think I put it in the last episode that we had discovered that Joseph Campbell lived in Woodstock and lived at the Maverick with all of that stuff going on in Woodstock and helped develop all of this stuff right at the core.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, as I've alluded to in the past, it's very important, you know, whether you believe in not quote unquote supernatural, numerology, occult stuff. The fact is that there are certain segments of the elites that do deploy specific locations. Just an example, the whole transgender thing is really connected with this as above, so below, the reversal of values. You know, it's actually an occult thing. This is very much an occult thing and actually goes back to this goddess who was worshipped with human sacrifice, actually in Syria. And so this goddess is having a sort of a resurgence, but basically some of the stuff is a bit weird in that, you know, it's hard just to take a rational explanation like why this stuff is being deployed. So, you know, whether it just has a psychological effect or something else, but certainly some of these techniques are being utilized. And some of it I'm sure is BS, but, you know, some of it may not be, especially when it comes to the music and stuff. But let me go ahead and roll this clip here. We'll just listen to for a couple minutes. So here we go.
Tonight is the seventh in the series of programs sponsored by Esalen Institute on the value of psychotic experience. Tonight's presentation is entitled The Poetry of Madness. The people up here are, on my right, Dr. John Perry, San Francisco psychiatrist, Dr. Claudio Naranjo, a Chilean psychiatrist. My name is Julian Silverman. I'm a research psychologist. This is Allen Ginsberg. Need more be said? Alan Watts. Need more be said? We are going to explore tonight the poetic aspects of what we tried to do last night in the name of science, but which were limited by the necessity of being very analytic and rational and sometimes oversensible. What we are seeking to understand is the sense in the non-rational, the wisdom in the union of opposites, and the reasonableness of the term losing your mind to come to your senses. John, would you please?
I think it wouldn't be right to start the evening's discussion without reference to the man who first went into this question some thousands of years ago, Plato, who is the first of our great psychologists. He had a good deal to say about madness and the absolute necessity of madness in creative thinking and in the enlarging of awareness. He said, in proportion as prophecy is higher and more perfect than divination, both in name and reality, in the same proportion is madness superior to the sane mind, for the one is only of human, but the other of divine origin. Again, where woes have bred in a race, owing to some ancient wrath, their madness, lifting up her voice and flying to prayers and rites, has come to the rescue of those in need. He who has part in this gift and is truly possessed and duly out of his mind is by the use of purifications and mysteries made whole, and delivered from evil, future as well as present.
Sir, can your discourse be heard?
Can it be heard?
If you pull the microphone closer, perhaps.
Closer? Is that a little bit better? Oh, I'm sorry. Well, it was Plato talking. And there is a third kind of madness, which is a possession of the muses. This enters into a delicate and virgin soul, and their inspiring frenzy awakens lyric. But he who, not being inspired and having no touch of madness in his soul, comes to the door and thinks that he will get into the temple by the help of art, he, I say, and his poetry are not admitted. The sane man is nowhere at all when he enters into rivalry with the madman.
Okay. Well, there's a lot there. It's over like 2 hours. But guess where that was recorded, Jan?
Esalen.
It was Esalen Institute offering at the Longshoremen's Memorial Hall, where they're having all the acid tests.
Okay.
So this was at, you know, where they had this big gathering. I played some of those clips back, I think, the first or second episode. So these are, you know, all these luminaries are coming and talking, and they even describe our experience last night here, which is not recorded, I assume. They were probably tripping. But that's actually where, you know, of course, it was one of the major centers for these big, you know, acid tests, right? The acid tests started out there. So this is where this was presented. It kind of goes on and on, but I mean, the basic gist is that madness itself is holy, meaning sacred. It's transformative. It is the way to liberation. It is beautiful. It is the source of arts, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, even though they're sort of alluding to the fact that these are schizophrenogens, right? So I thought that was kind of interesting parallel where they're giving these lecture series. And we, you know, there's a lot of stuff in there. We can spend a lot of time talking about that. But you see the normalization, right, of this state, of the LSD state, coming from different angles, coming from the spiritual side. You're going to be liberated. And then now, with maybe a slightly more intellectual veneer, you're going to go insane. And this is going to set you free. Insanity is freedom, right? And
at the same time, telling everyone that insanity is the religious experience, and therefore remarketing the schizophrenogens and psychotomimetics as psychedelics and entheogens.
Exactly. And so you kind of get both sides covered. You get the ecstasy side and you get the negative side.
Right.
I mean, like, for example, the Beatles were first given LSD by their dentist, and they tripped and they went to some club and they had an absolutely horrible time. You know, they had a bad trip. You know, their dentist dosed them, you know, supposedly. I don't know who the dentist was, but, and, you know, the first time they didn't like it. And then, of course, they just kept going into it more and more and more.
It was the DDS of LSD.
Yeah. Maybe it's Dr. Robert. But, you know, the interesting thing is that you have, you know, even these bands that are getting introduced to LSD at the same time, you have it moving more into the culture. You know, you have, of course, Ken Kesey, One Who Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. What's a better description of this guy who is in a mental hospital, and actually the insane people are sane. You know, the people that are locked in a mental institution are sane, and the society is insane. So that was kind of the premise of that. And then he's driving around the Merry Prankster bus, right?
Right.
Distributing LSD all over the country. At the same time, all these radio stations are coming up. So that's kind of, that would probably conclude the first part there. But I don't know if you want to throw anything in on that of interest. Or
well, you know, Joe and I have been covering the whole Ken Kesey, Merry Pranksters, One Flew Over the Cuckoo Nest aspect as well. And that's a really good point about... And I think we were just coming to that same conclusion in one of the recent episodes as well, is trying to normalize insanity, trying to make insanity look cool, you know. And with Kesey's book, The Indian, going back off into you know, essentially he's the better state, this neo-feudalist native revivalist state coming back, where the drugs and insanity are somehow better, but always with someone else's outside control or influence, while the victim in that state always believes that they're the freest and, you know, not under any control, that by being on drugs and being high, they've escaped any control.
Yeah, no, exactly. And it's really interesting that one thing I kind of chanced upon, which times with all these things, 1963, 1964, is the changing of the Hippocratic Oath. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but they basically changed the Hippocratic Oath to allow the doctor to kill you, as well as to, they talk about, you know, in a negative chemical, you know, administering chemical mixtures, which is not in the original Hippocratic Oath. And this, all this stuff, you know, again, all this stuff is tied in and connects at the same, you know, 1963, you have these shocks, right? First wave of shocks, you know, and this collapse, where America actually could have been totally different, right? If John F. Kennedy had lived, we'd probably be in a far different society. But that assassination, and even that as just being image being played over and over again, you know, and all this stuff, was, you know, a massive collective shock that, you know, is even, I think, probably more than 9/11. And, you know, of course, other things go on. But so if you look at, again, back at these three stages, right, of, you know, where basically the psychotic values become normalized, you know, and moving towards this dissociated state. But in terms of the actual networks that are happening, that's a bit of the protocol, so to speak, or thinking behind it. And oh, by the way, the guy that changed the Hippocratic Oath, he was Louis Lasonga, who was, you know, he yelled this stuff about, you know, patient rights. He actually was working in World War II doing mescaline experiments on German prisoners of war. So he was doing mescaline experiments connected possibly with MK Ultra, and he's the guy that's the face of the compassionate doctor ethics and medical testing, and he came out of that stuff. But his background was doing mescaline testing. You know,
well, and the official story is that the Germans were doing the mescaline testing on the Jews, and, you know, the more I look into that whole history, the less I find to substantiate all of the Nazi connections for the defense of MKUltra.
Yeah. Well, you know, but what's interesting is that the change of the Hippocratic Oath basically allows for a level of human experimentation on a broad scale, which was, you know, about to erupt throughout the United States. So I just thought that's kind of an interesting connection. I think there's probably more there if I look into it more, but maybe, you know, bring up the Hippocratic Oath and just see how they changed it and what they took out, you know, basically where originally Hippocratic Oath, the doctor tries to heal you using, you know, holistic health, dietary means, all this other stuff, right? They changed it. And basically, you know, so it's a little bit, it's not, you know, I guess you can't call them hypocrites because the oath, you know, read between the lines or just right in the surface, it's pretty wild how this kind of corresponds with all those other things. But so in terms of how the sort of development of underground radio, how this helped to create or formulate a counterculture, well, there was already a set of networks in place, right? These were at universities, you have a coffee shop, you have in different cities, there were all kinds of participants, and this was in the folk music circle. And in fact, the folk music was something where, in a sense, it was called a co-option, but this was where the Popular Front, which was, this was approved by the 7th Congress of the Communist International in 1935. And there's a quote from a scholar, Howard Husak. He says, quote, The Popular Front tasked communists in the West with building progressive coalitions with various institutions, including political parties and labor unions, that the party had previously denounced as bourgeoisie and corrupt. Following this new strategy, the American Communist Party suddenly asserted that it wanted to build upon, not destroy, American institutions. The Popular Front sought to enlist Western artists and intellectuals, some of them not party members, but fellow travelers, to use art, literature, and music to insinuate the Marxist worldview into the broader culture. And specifically, the aim was to take the music of the rural poor South, which they eventually termed it as folk music, right? It wasn't called folk music. This was the music people played in the South, and they liked it, and that was part of their culture. But they tried to transform that music to use it as a vehicle to introduce Marxist cultural vernacular into the culture. And even Alan Lomax's cantometric system was also part of this. And this was, it was a little bit hard to find, but I found some books on this, that specify how all the debates they had, how to create the proletarian music, how to take the forms of the Western songs, but make them link so they capture the interest. But they're changing, say, for example, the largely Christian music of the South, changing into that music about, say, like Joe, the guy was a Joe Hill, the legendary worker who was like martyred, et cetera. So the whole folk music movement with Bob Dylan was a part of was directly connected with communist cells. And so Bob Dylan himself, when he was traveling around, he went to, it was University of Madison. They had this, he stayed with, his friends in the Communist Party and the communist cells, right? So they had, these networks were set up all over the country, right? They had specific people in different places. They had activists, again, going to the rural South. They had activists going here and there. And they had musicians who either, by being part of the scene or deliberately were conveying the values through the folk music, which again was changed and transformed, but also placed in a context of being a way to liberate the deluded poor, primarily poor white Southerners, but everyone else in the country. So that was kind of the subterranean text of the whole folk music movement. But again, it wasn't just guys, crashing in someone's place, in a coffee shop, they're playing guitar. No, I mean, they're staying with members of the Communist Party, and they're deliberately seeing how to transform music and use this as a tool of social transformation, or you could say called social engineering, cultural engineering, et cetera. So I think this becomes kind of the foundational point a little bit for when we start to move in just a couple of years later with the underground radio stations. We see that this serves as sort of the nexus for sort of the distribution of LSD, but also the transformation of the folk music scene into the psychedelic music scene, right? So Bob Dylan started going electric, and you have all these folk bands starting to go electric and becoming psychedelic, right? So that psychedelic music really grew primarily out of the streams of folk music, right? It was mostly the folkies, like Jerry Garcia was playing bluegrass, et cetera, et cetera. And I can go into that in more detail, but basically the folk music scene was the starting off point, again, which especially San Francisco, et cetera, grew into the psychedelic music and these directly, again, linked with Communist Party and their official documents right there, even though, of course, they got shut down a bit by the House Committee for Un-American Activities. But that, I think, sort of shows that also even the Bob Dylan going electric, I think there's, if I look into that more, I bet I could find more reasons for that. Because, again, he was directly linked with part of the Communist Party, part of, he was staying with these people. He was being introduced. He was getting a lot of propulsion in his career by these particular people. So you wonder, going electric kind of marked the beginning of all, again, the folk music going into this psychedelic rock. And this kind of sprung up in different centers or regions across the state. So you have in Austin, Texas, you have San Francisco, you have the Charlatans, you have Detroit, et cetera. So you have these different regions, New York City, of course, where this music started sort of bubbling up. So I don't even want to throw anything in on there about that.
No, not particularly.
not falling asleep there. Right? I'm just kidding.
No, so, not at all.
Okay. But, and I have a map I'm working on. I actually got, I got all these maps of the different radio stations and where they showed up, and these big maps, you know, from the library. Of course, I had to take pictures of them. So I may provide some kind of a image or a slide from that. So anyways, from here, right, we now move into the birth, so to speak, of the FM radio, again, which you've talked about quite a bit, but I want to just go in a little bit more detail regarding sort of how this worked, right? And as I did more research, I did find out that this actually was much, you know, even though, again, it's sort of, we're supposed to think that freeform radio just popped up in 1967 with Tom Donahue. The fact was that you already have Crab, K-R-A-B, the Crab Nebula. And it was also known by, I think one of the guys called it, what did he call it? The DJ there. It's kind of a funny, Kilo Mother Pot X-ray. That's a different radio station, Kilo Mother Pot X-ray. But basically, the Crab station was like really one of the first underground radio stations. This guy had, his name was Milam, and he had some money. He had enough money. He had a couple $100,000 floating around. And the Crab started to do fundraising. I just want to read about one of their fundraisers, November 9th, 1963. This is 4 years before supposedly freeform radio started. So Crab will conduct its first gigantic marathon in order to raise $100,000 for the station. Pledges will be solicited disarmingly frequent intervals. We will have a squad of motorcyclists to identified by hearts and Crab tattooed on their arms, ready to go out and pick up the pledges. So they kept asking for money. They're getting funds, but basically the Crab, I talked about this guy last time, and he had this manual, right? How to start underground radio stations, right? So this was sort of underground manual. This got shared and disseminated throughout the country. At the same time, we have other underground stations coming up in 1966. Of course, Pacifica is always there. And Pacifica also very much connected, again, with Allen Ginsberg, with some of these other players, especially in the...
Alan Watts, the Grateful Dead, all on and on.
Yeah. In fact, the first totally openly gay homosexual show was broadcast on Georgetown University's FM radio station in the early 60s. And they talked about venereal disease, where to meet guys. I mean, it was just a straight up, you know, I mean, pretty over the top, especially then. So that was happening. Supposedly, they said that the authorities at Georgetown didn't know. They didn't ever listen to the radio station, so they had no idea that this extremely shocking show, you know, I mean, again, talking about. Anyways, so, but where we see it become very interesting, I think, is that so we have people like Jay Kyle, and he had Q clearance, which is actually the Pentagon's highest access credential. And he was the judge assigned to for the FCC case for this first underground radio station. So it's kind of weird they bring in such a big gun. But anyways, when we go back to the other station, KPFK, which is the other Pacifica station in New York City. And this is really...
KPFK
really
is in Los Angeles.
WBAI
is in New York.
WBAI, yeah. Sorry, yeah. And so basically that station, you have the, you know, Bob Fass, who I've talked about a little bit, but Bob Fass was somebody that not only was he running this radio, a nameable Good Morning Cabal, talking a lot about, you know, and one thing to state that goes through these books, these people were pushing drug use nonstop. on these stations. They were constantly talking about drugs. Yeah, and even it says sometimes they would even act it, they're like they were high if they weren't, but there was a constant drumming until 1971 it finally was banned. It was so pervasive and pernicious that they had to ban, the FCC finally banned the drug, pushing the drugs on the air.
I have a number of shows from the She Hura Members Archives. In fact, I finally just had the trash man this morning drive off with a couple of boxes left over that I just would never get to convert to MP3 this morning. But anyway, in there are several psychedelic radio episodes that they did on KPFK. Where it was just them in a room full of people pretending or being on LSD on the air.
Yeah.
You know, and I remember Jeannie was telling me that she wasn't high, but I remember her telling me decades ago about these recordings, and I wonder if these were all staged looking back, you know, just to promote the whole drug theme and just say whatever absurd, stupid stuff comes up on the KPFK Los Angeles airwaves.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting that, you know, the reason that the whole I just want to make sure I have the right station here. Yeah, I'm sorry, I wrote down the wrong call numbers. But WBAI, this guy, supposedly this philanthropist, Louis Schweitzer, Russian-born industrialist, he bought the station, the WBAI station, for $34,000, and he bought it because he said he wanted to hear more classical music, and then he gave that to Pacifica. He just gave it away. And so it was, I guess, nice of him, but he just gave them that station. Otherwise they probably couldn't have afforded it. But from that station, we have Bob Fass coming out. And Bob Fass was a major figure in the counterculture of the left, a major figure in giving early artists like Bob Dylan access to bohemian circles, to politically active people, left-wing experimental people, etc. People like Abby Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, Ed Sanders, Paul Krasner, radical hippies, and Bob Fass with them formed the Yippies. So he was actually the founder of the Yippies, one of the founders of the Yippies, and this is the freeform radio sort of legend. And so we see this FM station under Bob Fass's hand being utilized. They used it as their central communication system. They directly said, we use this radio station as our central communication system when we're doing activism to, you know, to do all kinds of weird media pranks. You know, mentioned some of them, like, you know, where he had the fly-in, he got thousands of people to go show up at the airport. He had the clean-in where he got thousands of hippies to go out and start scrubbing the streets of New York. And actually then the city decided to start cleaning up the streets too, but he was able to mobilize thousands and thousands of people via the radio station. So it's not just playing music, it's mobilizing these networks of activists, right? And as I mentioned with this idea of these networks, you can have one agent, right? You may have these spins, you may have a couple group of friends here and here, but with that agent, that centralizing agent can bring all these people together.
Absolutely. And then, and then, if you look at it in the form of one of Buckminster Fuller's domes, and each node kind of has three connecting points, then you can see how they can utilize and spread this stuff across. But I think Buckminster Fuller is key to understanding how they created and implemented these networks.
Yeah. Well, you know, and this, they noted these unnameable family, right? And so this whole idea of like media pranksters, and they did stuff, and Rubin and Hoffman, all these guys, they would mobilize all the hippies to go out and do these, you know, freak out people, show up at Grand Central Station with a bunch of hippies. Hey, you know, like Allen Ginsberg, if you ever seen this, it's pretty hilarious where he was on, William F. Buckley's show, and Allen Ginsberg shows up. Have you ever seen that?
I just watched it last week, I think.
That's hilarious. He's like playing his cheesy harmonium and just, just such an annoying. The thing is, he's a pedophile, man. I mean, you just got to keep that in mind. And also, Jack Kerouac described how he was dosed, right? He was dosed by him. And he said his mind was never right again after that. He said, something happened to me that night. He was given some mescaline by Allen Ginsberg. He said, I never recovered. My mind has been messed up since that one trip. So you wonder about that too. But anyways, so the Yippies, they're one of the most iconic events of the 1960s with the Chicago riots, and Radio Unnamable and Bob Fass was a major, in fact, they would claim to be the major implementers of that entire series of riots, what was going on. They were coordinating people on the air. Here's a quote, quote, the whole Chicago Democratic Convention was organized on BAI. You just sat there and listened to it. We all should have gone to Chicago and been tried as conspirators instead of just the Chicago Seven, because we're all in on it. Everybody made phone calls. Everybody made suggestions. The whole thing was planned on Bob's show. So so we have Altamont, the sweep-ins, Woodstock. So all these things are covered. These riots, they're talking about people dying. It's actually provoking the riot. People listening to the radio, during the riot, it's actually the main thing. So the Chicago 8, actually Bobby Seale, who was a Black Panther, which I'll talk about them in a second. Bobby Seale was actually tried. And many have said that the whole Chicago 7 trial was just a farce. And if you look at some of these financial documents, which Matt alluded to, is that they actually were getting funding, right? They're getting funding in, a couple $100,000. I have the exact amount here from various foundations funneled through the CIA. So these radical hippies, these are the iconoclastic ultimate hippies, right? Steal this book, Abbie Hoffman, complete living the full lifestyle, the drugs, the rebellion, everything.
Well, this all falls under the New Left, and the New Left goes directly up into Marxism. Theodore Adorno, the Tavistock Institute, etc., composes of people like Students for Democratic Society, Noam Chomsky, Artie Lang, and then of course Jerry Rubin, the Diggers, Cesar Chavez, all of the Yippies under Walter Boart, who wrote Operation Mind Control, who is of course Peggy Mellon Hitchcock's husband of the Millbrook Mansion and all of that. So this is right at, it's just another level of the same group of communist CIA agents, essentially.
Yeah. Well, and actually, you look at Wavy Gravy, also got his first exposure with Bob Fass. And Wavy Gravy, he's that guy has got all kinds of, you want to say a little something about him? Because he's definitely an interesting.
Well, he's, of course, he was one of the merry pranksters tied to the Grateful Dead, the Church of the Subgenius, which of course is Discordianism under Bob Dobbs, who I also talk about in the Spies and Academic Clothing article. So he's one of these Discordian types. He's Camp Winter Rainbow Digital BN. He runs the Hog Farm at the Woodstock Music Festival, where, in the Hog Farm, if you get it, it's a joke on the Gentiles. But the Hog Farm is apparently where they took care of the people on the bad trips at the original Woodstock Music Festival. So that ties there to Wavy Gravy. He's also tied to Richard Alpert, to Ram Dass, also to Stephen Hager, whose quote we just read a little bit ago. Hager, of course, was the chief editor of High Times. Ram Dass worked with Leary and the rest of the MKUltra crew out of the Harvard Social Relations Department. He's also tied to Lenny Bruce. We've got him connected to Bob Fass there, who you just spoke about. And again, WBAI, Allen Ginsberg, Tim Leary. It's the same group of people. It's the same stuff.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so this we have these guys, again, the Chicago 7. Of course, Bobby Seale ended up getting down the drain. And they actually had two trials. The first trial was secret, where they passed this anti-riot act. And then the second trial was the big, the movie about where they're all, being so radical and revolutionary, but they were getting financial backing, and even a lot of their press was coming through these underground papers. And there's something known as the Kinney Corp, which bought about 60% of the underground papers, which is there's some CIA members on the board. So, I mean, Underground Papers obviously is not important.
Well,
now,
but you know, well, who ran, what, speaking of all of this, I just mentioned all of the Mellon Hitchcock family and Walter Boert. Walter Boert ran the, what was it? The East Village Other, where they promoted all of these things and the Pentagon protests and all of this stuff. So I'll bet you that Walter Boert and the East Village Other were behind the promotion of the Chicago riots and the Chicago Seven.
Yeah. And you have Chicago Seven, their organization, they had a company, a front company, well, they were like their corporation called the National Mobilization to End the War in Vietnam. They were getting $192,000 in federal money, $85,000 from the Carnegie Foundation. They got another $193,313,000 from the Federal Office of Economic Opportunity, through the Institute of Policy Studies, through the think tanks, ACLU, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, New World Fund, Aaron E. Norman Fund, and there's actually IRS documents. And the Kaplan, and these guys are connected directly with the CIA, Senator Saltonstall, who's with on the Kaplan Foundation, is also connected with the CIA, Richard Baldwin Foundation, also... Tom Hayden is, you know, I mean, was basically a deep cover agent going through that whole thing. And actually, you know, even, you know, Abby Hoffman was like, you know, meeting up, I think he, if I remember correctly, maybe he met with Claire Booth Luce or someone like that. You know,
oh yeah. Well, I've got him quoted in, now I'm forgetting which article. It's in one of my articles in the series. It could be the first one on Wasson or maybe, Manufacturing the Deadhead, but Abby Hoffman was meeting up with Claire Booth Luce at the Republican National Convention of all places. And in fact, yeah. I'll pull that quote up here while you're talking, and I'll read it. But it's a worthy quote there.
But check this out: they had command centers. Their command centers, again, with Bob Fass and mobilizing thousands and thousands of people to get their asses kicked. Chicago's old colony building, 408 South Plymouth Court, one block from the federal building. They also had...
Let me read this quote really quickly. This is from Abby Hoffman. And this is from the Manufacturing the Deadhead article that Joe Atwell and I wrote. He says, "I've always maintained that Henry Luce did more to popularize acid than Timothy Leary. Years later, I met Claire Booth Luce at the Republican convention in Miami. She did not disagree with this opinion. America's version of the Dragon Lady caressed my arm, fluttered her eyes, and cooed. We wouldn't want anyone doing too much of a good thing," quote unquote. And so there's so many things going on here, but here's this media mogul's wife, you know, the head of Time Life magazine's wife, Claire Booth Luce, caressing Abby Hoffman's arm, who was doing all of these, you know, social programming movements in Chicago and elsewhere. I mean, this is... Folks, you got to wake up, man. I mean, these cultural heroes, Timothy Leary, Terrence McKenna, Wavy Gravy, Jerry Garcia, the Doors, you name it. I mean, you know, folks, wake up. Richard Alpert, Ram Dass, all of them. This is the intelligence community. These are the agents, folks. You know, get over the idea that the CIA are a bunch of dummies going around in black suits, you know, and, oh, we're just dumb, we don't get anything. No, you're the dummy, you're the dupe. They're the ones wearing the tie-dyes and leading all of these movements. What the hell is a movement? Is it a bowel movement? You know, truth doesn't come in a movement. Truth is about checking and verifying facts on a case-by-case, point-by-point basis. There's no movement about it. It's not going into the bathroom and having a bowel movement, folks. You know, it's not a groupthink. A truth happens on a case-by-case, point-by-point basis by checking things out. And if you're caught into some movement, whether it's the stupid 60s movements or the Wall Street movements of today or the New Age movement, all of this stuff, veganism, vegetarianism, feminism, all of these movements. This is what the Central Intelligence, the Central Entertainment Agency does. So please, folks, pull your heads out of your butts if you don't get it yet.
Yeah. And, you know, just to, you know, go over this real quick again.
Excuse my rant.
No, that's fine. Just to, maybe I'll get warmed up for a rant too. So, you know, they're doing this type of, again, social disruption, social disorder, right? And that's exactly, we're talking about these stages, right? Of the social, implementing widespread social disorder. Because again, if you're not a hippie, there were a lot of hippies, or a majority of people weren't hippies. This was very disturbing. But they were staying in the office. One of their headquarters, command and control centers for the Chicago riots, was in a director of labor. But this particular guy was running counterinsurgency operations in African countries. So his deputy labor director office was basically, you know, was running, was a front for counterinsurgency stuff. So why, if you're running counterinsurgency operations in Africa, why not run one right here in Chicago? So really what you see is these icons, the major news media now begins to collude with the radio to create the image of these radical icons. You know, they're getting stoned in front of the judge and dancing around, and that, and this is they just rolled this stuff out a couple of years ago. You know, they did a rethink on the Chicago 7 thing. And then we find also that, you know, there's some planned jurors. Some of the jurors were working with the CIA. We see, again, all this money. We see they're staying in these different foundation places. And basically, I mean, they were, you know, and certainly some of these judges, the judge was basically, you know, got called out for, you know, taking some kind of a bribe. So he basically was shut down. And so this whole thing, and this is just one example, not only being directed, but everyone is getting, this is an idea of, there is locational identity and then there is associational identity, right? So people have this identity to this association. Like, okay, I'm a Catholic. I'm a, you know, I'm a downhill skier. I mean, maybe that's not a very good association, but these, so people create these,
Sonny Bono.
Sonny Bono. Yeah. So, but anyways, so, you know, if you're wondering, Bob Fass and these are guys promoting the psychedelic culture. These are the guys running the underground newspapers. These are the guys that are the most iconic, even more so than the musicians, in that they're actually on the streets, you know, and they're helping to organize all this stuff. So we're looking at the Longshoreman's Ball. We suddenly see this network, and, you know, I might, you know, at one point go into more detail, but the Yippies being invented on the radio by Fass, you know, I mean,
well, wait a second, but let's go back, because who is the first Yippie? You don't know. All right, well, let's bring this back full circle, because it's been about 2 or 3 minutes. Walter Boert, Operation Mind Control, was the first Yippie. Walter really? Boert, the East Village other. Walter Boert, Peggy Mellon Hitchcock's brother. Walter Boert, brother-in-law to Billy Mellon Hitchcock of the Millbrook Mansion, was the first Yippie.
And interesting that the account that I'm reading in some of these scholarly books, they just fail to mention that.
Oh, of course. Well, you know, I mean, and throughout the whole book, Operation Mind Control, Walter Boert even fails to mention that Peggy Mellon Hitchcock, his sister or his wife, her brother, owned the Millbrook Mansion, and that she funded the Grateful Dead and all of this stuff. You know, they were behind all of this stuff.
Certainly, East Village Other was creative in graphic design and all that stuff, and that's Walter's artistic part. Okay, so then he meets Peggy Hitchcock, and he told me later that he became the first yuppie. And they got married about 69, I think, 68, 69, 70, and they end up in Tucson, Arizona, and that's when he went New Agey. He created the Omen Press. Oh, I should say that he gave up the East Village Other because he didn't like the way the interpersonal hassles that was happening at the paper and around it. He just didn't want to keep being harassed, because basically Walter was a guy looking for slack, you know, artistic, aesthetic slack, and he wasn't going to take something so seriously that he could lock down in it and become a fanatic about it. If it was causing Ed headaches, not fun anymore, he'd leave. So he finds himself on Arizona, and he starts his press, and he meets Sufi Sam. He talked about Sufi Sam to me a lot, and he was impressed with the guy and promoted him and wrote his book. But in 68, 69, it would have to be before Nixon was elected in the fall of 68. He always had this story, and any close friends he would tell the story. He was hanging out with the Mellons, going to their family reunions. It's huge. I was once in Peggy's house and saw a picture of one of these reunions. It's like 1,000 people, like many families, many relatives all come together. There's probably about 150, 200 people, but it looks pretty impressive. And so he was at one of these reunions, being introduced to the Mellon relatives in 68. And somebody like the family accountant or one of the accountants or the family lawyer said to him, here's what he said. We're going to put Nixon in office. We're going to create a depression and make it a privilege to have a job. Now, I don't know if they knew who Walter was. Don't know why they told him, but he heard that said to him. And that just think of that. You know, you're right there among the so-called elite of America, and you hear that statement. You're already prone to be suspicious of people or of the elites. I mean, you can't say Walter was a communist or an anarchist. He did, the first issue of the East Village Other featured Alfred Jarry's pataphysics design, so he was a pataphysician, which led into a Yippie sensibility, and he was at the founding of the Yippies.
So, you're saying it was a Walter Bart, so this is the, even though, Bob Fazer said, you know, it was a founder, so we got the act, maybe the, so he actually came up with the idea for the Yippies, so that guy... was the progenitor of the Yippies. Wow.
As far as I know, it was Walter Boert who came up with the Yippies. Maybe Bob Fass promoted them. I do have Bob Fass and Walter Boert as showing up as friends, but or I think I do here. Let me just check that.
Well, Bob Fass is listed as being one of the founders of the Yippies. So he was like one of the original members and founders.
Yeah, I'm adding that right now because I have the Yippies as being founded by Walter Boert and the Diggers. Well, and then that influences Abby Hoffman, Paul Krasner, and Are You Serious? So, yeah, I mean, here we are right at the nexus of this stuff again. So Walter Boert is actually a much larger key player than we had previously suspected.
Well, it lists here as the original members of the Yippies are Abby Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, Ed Sanders, and Robert Fass. And they say that actually these guys were attracted to the Yippies by the radio show and because of it. So that's what it says there. And this goes directly to the Chicago 7 riots and all this stuff. So I think that we've got a pretty... interesting connection. And then we have Tom Donahue again, who's the whole star of that FM radio. He doesn't get on the scene until 1968. So that's quite late when you're missing out on these earlier radio stations. KMPX was running during the Summer of Love, which wasn't even mentioned in that whole thing. And of course, they call it his Kilo Mother Pot X-ray. That's how they use the moniker. But this guy who's a DJ there just talks about, you know, pretty much nonstop promoting the counterculture, promoting drugs all the time. And he said, you know, we had just basically, you know, Spiro Agnew eventually stopped that because, I mean, they were constantly, every second we were, you know, promoting drugs. And one thing to note, if you look at sort of how social movements work by obscenity, by shock, by things like that, you sort of shock people's consciousness and you're able to not only disrupt the social order, but to attract people, you know, to your message, to your thing, to this kind of the shock kind of dislodges, you know, the normal conventions, you could call, as LeComin called, the symbolic order. To cover just a few more things. I mean, just to show that this is not something that is just, you know, like I said, this is a much simpler case, and it's much easier to understand in that we can look at all the players and see exactly how it was deployed and how it played out. So we look at the Black Panthers, right? The Black Panthers being part of this idea of radical revolutionary movement, social rights, et cetera. And what we have in 1967, we have this sudden growth of gang crime in Chicago, right? You have Martin Luther King going to Chicago, and basically they're saying, we don't really have a problem with integration. We don't have a problem like the South, where we have our own neighborhoods. But actually, part of what Martin Luther King was doing was removing some of these ethnic neighborhoods, population replacement. You have the rise of the Black Panthers. I'm sure you're familiar with them. They actually started out as being kind of a, you know, positive.
And they were the new left also. They were a part of this whole manufactured creation, you know, that came out of the Marxists. Tavistock Institute, Adorno, et cetera.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Black Panthers, I mean, they started out as sort of kind of having a positive influence, and then they got infiltrated by this guy. He actually is like a kind of Asian American looking guy. I'm not recalling his name. He recently came out and said he was a FBI informant the whole time, and he brought them weapons. He brought them weapons, and then they were drugged. They were drugged, and basically they were assassinated in Chicago. Most of the leaders were murdered when they were drugged with barbiturates. But anyways, one of the big players is a guy named Gordon Parks. And Gordon Parks he worked with Henry Luce at Time or Life magazine, and he was very black, dark-skinned guy. But he was out there infiltrating the Nation of Islam, getting photographs of all their leadership. He was infiltrating the Black Panthers. He was infiltrating all of these movements, collecting data, basically spying on them. And because they had, at this time, the darker your skin was, the more black you were. So they trusted him because he was so dark skinned. So Gordon Parks, who was getting debriefed by the FBI and the CIA, gave them enough data, information to have a bunch of Black Panthers murdered. Guess what he did after that? He directed the movie Shaft. He was the director of the movie Shaft, which was a transformation of black cultural identity from the revolutionary to the pimp, right? And so he directed Shaft, and his son directed Superfly. And this, at the same time, Sergeant Shriver, the head of the Office of Economic Opportunity in Chicago, gave the Blackstone Rangers, a Chicago gang, almost $900,000, basically allowing them to engage in gang-related activity. So you see direct funding of a gang, and primarily what the gang was doing was removing Catholics and other people from ethnic neighborhoods from the south side of Chicago. But you see that this guy, you know, working, you know, Life magazine, you know, the whole thing, Gordon Wasson, on the other side of the counterculture, look how this movement, they promote revolution, and then suddenly they get shut down, promote gang activity, and promote this pimp.
And they also promoted the feminism with Steinem, Joyce Glassman, Daniel Pinchbeck's mother, promoting black macho and all of that, which destroys the black family in the inner cities. So then this further ties into the connection to the violence, the drugs, them co-opting the Black Panthers, targeting Catholics, etc. So this is just one massive onslaught, essentially, against the black community, and then using that as a bludgeon against the rest of society.
Yeah, well, you know, basically, here's what Gordon Parks said in his memoir. He said that, quote, before I could pursue my newfound interest in the movies, I was called back to life to cover the Black Panthers. And actually what he did, covering the Black Panthers, he went in there, infiltrated them, gave enough information that they were assassinated. They were drugged and they were murdered. So he was the direct conduit for that event to happen. And also they got arrested, you know, the ones that survived. So that was shut down. So at the same time, you've got all this gang activity. You suddenly have, you know, these activist leaders being murdered, fleeing the country, just being wiped out, jailed. And, you know, so you have these black communities under gang activity, you know, their icons have been shattered, whatever, you know, Martin Luther King or MLK has been murdered. You know what I mean? So you have this whole tumult going on, and then suddenly you roll out with Shaft. And anyone seen Shaft? Shaft, he's a bad mother. Whoop. And it's a, you know, blaxploitation film about this, you know, guy basically, you know, it becomes the pimp. The icon of black culture is the pimp, the drug dealer, the guy that sleeps with lots of women, the guy that's selling cocaine, the guy that's, you know, basically his rebellion is wearing his hat and going out and getting money from his girls and, you know, having four or five women with him and doing a bunch of coke and shooting some people up. That is the new icon. The pimp is the icon, and it's continued to be the icon pretty much till this day. You look at hipster, it's been rolled out in different forms. This is the first thing you can say. The gang culture, gangster rap is a much
hip-hop,
more violent.
Even, you know, all of that stuff, it's still a continuation of that same theme, essentially.
Yeah.
Of the pimp theme.
Yeah, and, you know, I won't go, I mean, Shaft, I mean, I find these movies to be kind of funny, so I think they're entertaining, but, like, you know, Superfly, actually, I know one of the guys in his band, personally, he was actually in one of my classes, and he's in the Superfly scene with Curtis Mayfield. But anyways, the plot of Superfly is this guy is a drug dealer, pimp, and he's trying to do a big deal so he can retire. He wants to do one last big, you know, thing, and there's a bunch of, like, evil white cops, and they have shootouts, but basically he's just going to make it and go, you know, hang out on an island or something. Anyway, so he's a hero. And some of these movies just keep going. But Parks, the photographer Parks, you know, Gordon Parks, his liaison was none other than C.D. Jackson. You ever heard of him?
Well, C.D. Jackson hasn't come up for, like, I don't know. When was the last show we recorded? Joe and I were talking about C.D. Jackson the other day, so... C.D. Jackson, he becomes the president or CEO of Time Life magazine. He's actually the guy he's the same guy, ladies and gentlemen, who manufactured the official Holocaust story. And Council on Foreign Relations worked with Wasson, was under Dwight Eisenhower, under Alan Dulles, was also MI6, OSS, Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force. This guy was all over the place, tied with Arthur Colster, whom we've exposed a number of times, Ewan Cameron, John Foster Dulles. He's part of the Bilderberg Group, Fortune Magazine. He's connected to the JFK assassination. He's the guy, ladies and gentlemen, who bought the Zapruder film and hid it in, well, of course, in Zapruder, that's a whole other story because Zapruder worked for them too. But he buys the Zapruder film and then has it locked in the Time Life vault. So that's that, C.D. Jackson, folks. And so he's part of the Morgenthau Plan. He's involved in psychological warfare. Again, Time Life magazine. He's the guy, ladies and gentlemen, in the famous Buchenwald video where they're holding up the pelvis bone and the lampshade and saying that the Nazis created, you know, we're doing all of these as human experiments. That's C.D. Jackson, ladies and gentlemen, holding this stuff up. That's that guy.
We freeze the footage and look in the background. This hat isn't any old hat. It's a general's helmet. It has one star, meaning that he's a one-star general, in the same way that in different footage we see General Patton has three stars and General Bradley has four stars. This general is likely the chief of Allied psych warfare, a one-star general named Robert A. McClure, a photo of whom we find in the book Psych War. And here's McClure with his direct supervisor, Eisenhower. Compare the facial line at the side of the mouth. And guess who the guy is who held up the human pelvis ashtray? C.D. Jackson, his deputy.
Yeah, and now look also at what happened to the counterculture, and I'll just do a little mirroring of that with another person who's also linked with the Black Panthers. So, like, you have actually a very mature anti-war movement in the early 60s, guys in suits and ties that are serious, that are not, you know, that have a real point about the anti-war stuff, you know, And then suddenly you had these bearded freaks, you know, because the point was to stop the war. And these guys were not trying to destroy the foundations of Western culture and, you know, free love and whatever. They're out there, and this was completely shut down. So the anti-war movement was completely taken over. But let's look at another important film called Easy Rider, directed by Bert Schneider. And Bert Schneider, his first project was The Monkees. So he developed and ran The Monkees, the fake rock band. And then his first feature film was called Head, a psychedelic film featuring the Monkees. And then he did Easy Rider, which is the countercultural icon of the 1960s, the whole ideal of freedom, of whatever. And in fact, in that film, they are actually all the drugs in the film, they took all the drugs. They were on LSD, they were on cocaine, whatever. Every single drug consumed on that film was actually consumed on camera. That's Dennis Hopper. I'm sure people familiar with Easy Rider. So Easy Rider is another film which kind of parallels Shaft, right? You look at Shaft, and you look at Easy Rider. But the difference is that Easy Rider creates, you could say, the mythology of the hippie. It creates the mythology of the freedom. It shows this basically narrative, you know, their journey across the country again, to sell drugs. You know, they drive across country on motorcycles, and they have to deal with all the straight people, right? So it's this, it's showing this culture clash between the new culture, the defiant, you know, youth who are tripping balls all the time, you know, and balling chicks and just freaking out, and the normal straights who just can't get it and are the, represent the evil part of America. But at the same time, of course, it was a major type of social engineering as a major motion picture that really, in fact, created, again, part of the iconography, because at the same time Easy Rider came out, you have the slow disintegration or the rapid disintegration of they shut it down, right? At the same time, the mythos is taking off, the actual counterculture experience, at least if you look at Altamont, we talked about that in depth, you even look at Woodstock, you know, and other things. You have Bobby Kennedy's assassination. You have all these other sort of traumas that are inflicted. And that gets us, that opens us up right to the 70s, which is the next stage. You may call that the stage of dissociation or the beginning of that dissociation. But basically, what you end up having is a fragmented culture that people are trying to put back together again. And I don't think they've managed really to do that. And basically, you know, we can get into, you know, more details, but then, you know, when you look at just these two case studies and, you know, you look at the maps, whatever, you see how this stuff came out of these regions. And again, you know, probably 85-90% of the people involved were just, you know, along for the ride, having a good time. But this, it kind of explains how the music erupted so fast. We talked about the law change also, but the fact is that the activism, the drug promotion, all the other ideals were being pushed through the radio, through the news, underground newspapers, through these activists, through this film and other films, and this mythos. It was almost like they created a myth of this as like the great time of American history was this, the 60s. Like, we were really free. We had this revolution. We knew we were going to change. Revolution was in the air, right? And you look at these guys.
Manufactured freedom.
Manufactured freedom, and these guys are hanging out with government agents at Chicago 7.
We should have called this episode Manufactured Freedom or something. Maybe we'll have to use that for another title for something else.
Yeah, well, we can change the title, but I'm the Network, meaning what I'm talking about, I just discussed the title, I'm the Network talks about the final stage of the dissociated individual who embodies the network is kind of embodied in their mind.
Well, sure. I mean, it embodies itself as this presumed freedom, essentially manufactured freedom, you know?
Yeah. And it becomes sort of, as you move further, and I have a whole bunch of other things. I just a couple minutes here. I'm just to bring up a couple articles. I came across in my research about some, these newer developments. I'll just be real brief here. I got some weird stuff on like Russian electronics, and these are a bunch of Soviet patents and scientific articles. But there are basically, I'll just give an example of what this has evolved into. Here's an article, a scientific paper, crowd control through needs and personality modeling of NPCs using AHP. Research into crowd control enables human-like entities to mimic the behaviors of autonomy and basic human nature are underway to provide diversity in game elements. Crowd control in games includes behavior modeling and control techniques for single or group units of human-like entities such as NPC. So they're using artificial intelligence simulate. We have from this particular mapping and deployment of human networks, we've now moved to a much more scientific level of understanding, at least as example of mobile adaptive target tracking scheme based on prediction and wireless sensor networks. So this is actually using wireless networks to track people, to track people's movements, to model them within these simulated or virtual environments. This is remote monitoring of electric vehicle based on M2M and mobile platforms. So this is a way to use remotely monitor the movement and even control electric vehicles. Again, using this, some of this information learned through the sort of social upheaval in the 60s. This is another article, virtual gaming environments and we within. I'll read a bit of this quote. Since their advent, computer games have been getting more and more sophisticated, especially in terms of graphic granularity, due to fast advancing computer-related technologies, and are expected to develop into the level of perfectly simulating the real world in the not-so-distant future. This paper addresses the issues of virtual world environment, both at the current level and at the level of the one presented in the movie Matrix, in relation to the future of the gaming environment and the future of our reality. In doing so, the current status of computer games as virtual worlds and some views of what they evolve into are given. We'll then discuss what shape virtual worlds ultimately will take. And we also contemplate what kind of impact these virtual worlds will have on our real life. So this is talking about social virtual worlds. We're talking about living in this final state of dissociation where you're wired into a culture. We just talked about in the 70s. You're wired into this culture, and the network is actually just your own relationship to this virtual world, or in a sense, you're also, you know, being modeled and tracked throughout this thing, everything you do. So anyways, a lot of these things, again, wouldn't have been possible through the social transformations of the 1960s, and certainly hopefully in the series, I think we demonstrated that FM radio was a lot more important than we thought. And it turns out to be actually one of sort of the key points tying in a whole bunch of these other entities.
Say network of networks at all. All right, so let's see. Is there anything we didn't cover today, Hans? Is this? Are we wrapping up the secret history of FM radio here?
Yeah, you know, I think at this point that I'm going to start getting into so many little minute details, I'm probably going to write something up here because, you know, get a big picture. But I think this is probably our last show unless, you know, someone just like start getting inundated with phone calls, wreaths, flowers, chocolates, then maybe, but
24-year-old bottles of scotch begging us to do more.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause what have we done? Like 21, 22 episodes, something like that together now.
Yeah. We've done quite a bit. So,
I think this is probably the most extensive and explosive series ever done on these topics anywhere. And so huge thanks for being a part of this. Huge thanks for the Music Mind Control Psychobiology series, for helping me with the Princeton Radio Project and the War of the Worlds. Secret History of FM Radio. Tons of stuff there, ladies and gentlemen. This is a, I don't know, two-year college, university course just on these topics for you to understand and edify yourself. So let's see. Anything you'd like to add here, Hans?
Yeah, well, it's great. Great to be here. I do have sort of a blog. It's not super detailed, but it's called mindcontrolmusic.wordpress.com. So I'll maybe put some stuff up there. It's my own. My website is primarily like sitar booking and that kind of thing. But I really appreciate the audience for checking this out. And it's kind of funny. I've run into people all over, just random people that have seen, that know me from the show. I always say I look different in person. I'm like, I must look better. But yeah.
Well, you hope so. I don't know. I try to avoid the public. Well, that's good to know that it's getting out there. And hopefully it will continue to grow and spread and educate people. And maybe one day you and I will figure out another series or a bunch of shows or whatever to do. So anyway, that's a wrap, Hans. Thank you so much for taking part, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Jan. You have a wonderful day. God bless you. God bless America.
Take care, everyone.